This is the BBC.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book and luxury that they'd want with them when I cast them away. This is an extended edition of the original broadcast, although the music is shorter for rights reasons. I hope you enjoy the podcast. My castaway today is the tennis player and campaigner Billie Jean King. With 39 Grand Slam singles, doubles and mixed doubles titles to her name, she dominated the sport through the 60s and 70s. But given her on-court era, her struggles weren't just with her down-the-line forehand. In 1967, she won all 3 Wimbledon titles for the first time, singles, doubles and mixed doubles. Her prize? A £45 gift voucher. And so, at a time when women tennis players' frilly knickers drew as much comment as their sporting skills, my castaway became a campaigner too, fighting for equality within her sport and going on to found the Women's Tennis Association and the Women's Sports Foundation. Later still, she stayed in the headlines by becoming one of the world's most high-profile campaigners for gay and lesbian rights. She says, "I love surprising people and throwing stereotypes to the winds. We would all be a lot better off as a society if we stopped assuming people are the way we judge them to be based on their exteriors and tried to see things from their perspective." So welcome, Billie Jean King, to our little island. You've been coming to Wimbledon since 1961. You won here the first time that you visited. It was a ladies' doubles title. Nowadays, when you walk through these famous gates, what are your feelings about the place?
Well, this is my 58th year, so I have many, many memories that flood into my mind and in my heart, and I always think about the first time. You know, it was so amateur in those days and so small, so less commercial than it is now. Although I think Wimbledon's kept an unbelievable balance with commercial, keeping the tradition, and also having innovation as well. But when I go in, I think about how I used to buy bonbons to the right and go give them to the ball boys to the left. They didn't have any ball girls then. And I did talk to, I think, Captain Lane about ball girls, just say it would be nice to have both.
What did he say?
He said, "I hadn't thought about it." So sometimes it's just people don't think about it. And there's many ways you can try to change things. And I try to always start nicely. In fact, I try to do everything behind the scenes first. I mean, that's how we got equal prize money at the U.S. Open.
I was surprised to read you use the word about your sport. You describe it as entertainment. Given the amount of skill and discipline that goes into making a Grand Slam winner, how come you think of it in that way?
Everything's about the audience. Whether you give a speech or whether you are playing tennis at a professional level, first of all, I think you have the passion to play. That's first. And for me, I just wanted to be the best. I wanted to be number one. And when I was 11 years old, the second time I picked up a racket, went out to the park, they gave free instruction in Long Beach, California, where I'm from. I knew that's what I wanted to do with my life. And my mom says, "Calm down, you have homework and piano and all this." And I'm going, "No, Mommy, you don't understand. This is it. This is it." I just loved to play. But I had an epiphany at 12 years old. And I'd only played 1 year by then. And I was just sitting at the Los Angeles Tennis Club and daydreaming, and I started thinking about my tiny little sport of tennis, that everybody who played wore white shoes, white socks, white clothes, played with white balls, and everybody who played was white. And at 12, I asked myself, where's everybody else? And that's what started me fighting for equality. That very moment was my moment, my moment of truth.
Given that you haven't played professionally for a long, long time, where do you put your competitive spirit now? I mean, are you a demon poker player?
I'm not really so much a... I don't picture myself totally competitive. I'm much more of a perfectionist and like trying to always get better and learn, keep learning. There's 3 things I always talk about at commencement speeches and conversations, and like we're having right now. There's 3 things. And Ed Woolard, who used to be the president and CEO of DuPont, he's been a great mentor to me in my later business years. You know, we sit and talk, and I said, "Well, I need 3 quick things I can tell people they actually can remember and hold on to, and maybe it'll help them." And we came up with these 3 things. Relationships are everything. Keep learning and keep learning how to learn, and be a problem solver. So I find if you find people in your life that have the inner success, not just outer success, because most of that today is about money. People are always so in gaga with billionaires and all that. And I'm thinking, yeah, but what kind of person are they? You know, that's always my question.
I'm so glad to be talking to you today. Tell me, of course, we've got to hear the discs because one of the reasons I'm talking to you.
Yeah, which drove me absolutely crazy.
I'm sorry about that.
This show, Desert Island Disc, has driven me insane.
It's because, a kind of torture.
Well, I only wanted about 100. You know, I'm like, how am I going to do this? Chronologically? And then I thought about relationships or everything, and I thought I'd do that. Okay. People I've known. And I love to promote others anyway, so.
Well, tell me about your first disc then.
I know Aretha a little bit. When this song, Respect, came out, you have to remember the timing. It was in the 60s. We're just beginning the women's movement. And this song, Respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, was so important, I think. I think it made us women stand up a little straighter, a little more self-confidence. And, you know, women are taught to be perfect, and boys are taught to be brave. And we're not perfect. No one's perfect. But it gave us more self-respect and confidence, I think.
Was Aretha Franklin and Respect. Billie Jean King, you gave us a little, tiny little snapshot of your early life there. As you said, you were brought up in Long Beach in California. Mm-hmm. Your dad was Bill, a firefighter. Your mother, Betty, was a homemaker.
And then she started working later.
Did she?
She sold Avon and Tupperware.
It was interesting to read about the sort of values that were instilled. You know, in what you've written about your early family life, it strikes me repeatedly that this was very much a kind of values-based system. Flesh that out for me a little bit.
First of all, my dad being a firefighter, firefighters are the guys or the women who go in when everybody else is running out. He's really great in a crisis, but my parents were good citizens. They were risk adverse because they were depression children. My dad served in the Second World War. They're just basic, kind, hardworking, very strict, but very loving parents. They weren't perfect. They were homophobic. So later in my life, that was a challenge. But my brother and I go, you know, when you're young, you think your parents are so tough and this. And we realize now that we're very, very fortunate with the mom and dad we had.
And that structure then, so dinner was on the table at 5:15 and you better be there.
Oh, yeah, 5:30. And my brother and I'd be running down the street. Hurry, hurry, it's almost 5:30. We got to be on time. Oh, yeah, very strict, very structured. But I think that helps children, really, when they're young.
And Depression-era parents who made you very aware of the importance of money, of budgeting. How did they do that in a practical sense?
Well, my dad was not as good with money as my mother, so my dad would get his check and give it to my mother. And she was excellent. She could save money. My mom, Betty, made it work, even doesn't matter how much we had. And they were very good at saying no to us. I mean, we never went out to eat until I was 11, and she didn't let me have like two things sometimes. She'd say, like a milkshake, you know, and fries, but it's really fun. And she'd go, no, you can only have one. She'd make us aware of things, which I liked. And my dad was the same, really. He just knew. He said, oh, if I have the money, I'll have a hole in my pocket. So I give the money to your mom. And I think in every couple, whoever has the strength in certain areas, it's smart.
You said a very smart thing a moment ago before the last piece of music. You said, you know, females are brought up to be perfect and boys are brought up to be brave. Were you brought up to be perfect?
Yeah, my mother was always worried about me being a lady at all times, and she wouldn't let me play touch football, American football. By the time I was 10 or 11, I was furious. And she says, well, I want you to always be a lady. I go, what does that mean? I mean, really think about that. What does that really mean? I want to be a good person. I want to be... Anyway.
Did you articulate that at the time?
Oh, yeah. I was upset with her. Oh, yeah. I had no... We'd get into it. You know, I used to argue more with my dad probably than my mom, though, because my dad was such an athlete. He coached me. He was fantastic. Basketball was my first love. I played all team sports before tennis.
And Long Beach life is a very outdoorsy life. I mean, you've got the weather.
California? Yeah. We're 18 miles south of Los Angeles on the coast. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we didn't live on the coast because that's the rich kids. No, we lived on 36th Street, so we're 36 blocks from the ocean, which made it still very easy to go. It was beautiful. I mean, you do get a lot of luck. I mean, if you look at my lab, I had two parents who were fantastic. We had free access, free instruction for coaching. We had a very good school system at that time. So it was amazing life.
Time for some more music, Billie Jean King. Tell me about the second one.
Diana Ross Ain't No Mountain High Enough, because when the USTA, the governing body of tennis in the U.S., it'd be LTA here in Britain, decided to name the entire facility of the U.S. Open, which is huge, just like Wimbledon, you know, the grounds at Wimbledon, and they decided to name it after me. And the year they were doing that for me, that's was 2006, the person who sang was Diana Ross, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and then they introduced me. I used to argue with USTA all the time, so it's like full circle, and I'll never forget it, but I love Diana Ross, I love Motown, but this was special because of the moment. My dad had just passed away, but Ilana, my partner, my mother were there, and our nieces, and that night was really special.
And if you should miss my lover, one of these old days, if you should ever miss the arms that used to hold you so close, or the lips that used to touch yours so tenderly, just remember what I told you the day I set you free.
That was Diana Ross and Ain't No Mountain High Enough. So, Billie Jean King, you were around about, what, 10 or 11 when a friend suggested to you that you might want to play tennis. Is that right?
Yes. In fifth grade, Susan Williams, we were about 10 probably. She looked at me and she goes, do you want to play tennis? And I go, what's tennis? She says, you don't know what tennis is? I go, no. And I said, well, what do? She says, you get to run, jump, and hit a ball. I said, those are my three favorite things in sports. I can't wait. Let's go. And she belonged to a country club because her dad worked for Shell Chemical and had a really great job. And I don't know if I hit the ball or not. I can't remember. I know I had fun, but Susan was my best friend. But I thought, well, this will be nice if Susan takes me to the club, but I can't afford it. I should say we, my parents. Yeah. And so we also were on the softball team together, which is kind of like rounders.
Was that a girls thing? Was it just girls that played that?
Yeah, boys play baseball, girls play softball. That's a whole other discussion, which we're not going to get into, but which I don't agree with. But We went out to play at Houghton Park, and she told the coach, Val Halloran, oh, you know, I took Billy to play tennis the other day. And she goes, oh, well, they have free instruction here every Tuesday. I went, now we're talking. So the first time I went out to Houghton Park to get instruction from Clyde Walker, who I adored from the first moment. That's the moment when I told my mom, I know what I want to do with my life. I want to be number one tennis player in the world.
No, I've read this.
Yeah. So it was like,
for real? You said that for real?
Oh, absolutely for real. I was jumping up and down on the car seat, which I'm not supposed to do. That's why I remember it.
And what was it? It was just...
I love to hit the ball. There's nothing like running, feeling the wind in your hair. And when you hit the ball on the strings, it is just magic. Oh, my God, it's so much fun. It just feels great. And you have to bring all of yourself to be great in something anyway. But you have to truly bring all of yourself in tennis. It's upper and lower body. It's footwork. It's hand-eye. And there's something magical about the reflexes, and you feel the ball on the strings. It's just, oh my gosh, it's so much. It's just the best feeling. It's great.
I should tell listeners that when you're describing that moment of that sweet hit, and everybody knows it, even terrible players like me know it, you're closing your eyes in a kind of ecstasy. Do you still play for pleasure?
I've only played a couple times this year. I've had 8 knee operations. Oh, okay. I've had a foot operation. Okay. So I have to go work out a lot and do a lot of weights and a lot of things to be able to even play. Lana, my partner, who was number one in the world in doubles from South Africa, she still plays really well. And if we go out to hit, She put it right where I need it, so I don't have to run. Because it's hard.
Tell me about the $8.29 in the mason jar
that you collected. I went home and said, oh, I want to play tennis. And my dad says, oh, you do you? And my mom says, really? I said, Daddy, we need to get a racket or something. He goes, really? How are we going to do that? I said, I don't know. And he goes, well, you'll figure it out. My parents were always teaching my brother and I delayed gratification. I don't know if they realized it, but they were great life coaches. And I said, really? You won't buy me a racket? No. You say you really love it. You like it. Let's see how much. So I went to all the neighbors. They were so sweet. And they made up jobs for me. And they would give me a quarter or a dime or a nickel. And I'd keep saving it in the mason jar up in the cupboard. And finally, I had $8.29. And I could not wait any longer. I said, please, can we just go get my racket? So we walk into Brown Sporting Goods and they go, what would you like? We'd like a racket. I said, what can we get for $8.29? What can we buy for that? He started laughing. I remember this man. And he says, oh, here, come with me. We can figure this out. And of course, I love purple. It was really purple racket with the purple strings, the purple felt. I used to sleep with it. Oh my gosh, I was so excited.
Tell me this, as you describe that rather brilliantly about what your parents kind of made you do, they were teaching you lessons in life and also money was short. You know, yes. If a child these days, in most households, not every household, exhibits any kind of interest in anything, you know, the parents will support that. They'll try to get them the lessons if they can. They'll certainly get them the equipment. Which way is the best way to grow a champion?
Well, I don't think any parent should grow a champion. You've got to find out if somebody loves what they do. See, everyone's given a gift or gifts and blessings in life, and then that's usually your strength in life. And it really helps to usually follow that. And God gave my brother and I, thanks to Mom and Dad, great DNA for coordination. Although I wore glasses, when I put my glasses on, my eyes were amazingly still good. So we were really fortunate having our coordination. Piano was my first love, and they saved 5 years to get an upright piano for me. So when I started playing tennis, I said, Mom, I should quit piano. Tennis is it. And she goes, no, until you can actually read music, you are not giving up piano. And she was walking up and down the hallway. I'll never forget. She was furious with me. It was good furious, though, because she was right. It's like you can't just give up something after they've put that time and effort. And I did love it. It's just I didn't have it. So I knew early that God had given me my talent in my sports, and the teachers had written home. Mrs. Hunter in third grade, when you're, what, eight, she said, Billie Jean, you know, she's always chosen the captain. She loves pressure. Keep her in sports. Oh, it was so sweet. And teachers are so important. So anybody out there, if you're a teacher, professor, whatever, thank you.
We're going to hear your third disc, Billie Jean King. Tell me about this. Why is it on the list?
Nona Hendricks is a great friend. And she wrote this song. And, of course, Ilana is South African. So apartheid was big, and Nona and I have talked about it, but she wrote this beautiful song called Winds of Change, Mandela to Mandela, and I just love Nona. I don't think she gets enough attention. She's mentored a lot of people in music. Anyway, I just love her. I think she's got a great voice, and that's why I chose it, because everything's about relationships today.
Sometimes the winds of change blows your way. You can choose to run or stay and face the pain. Sometimes you don't know why you are caught. You stand for something, offer one and one for all. Only time will show why the wind would blow your way.
That was Nona Hendricks and Winds of Change. So Billie Jean King, by 1958, you had won the under-15 Southern Californian Championships. And you were obviously, you know, you're still at school at that time, but you were beginning to go outside the area and start to play. How did you afford? That must have been expensive.
It was very expensive. I got very fortunate. People in Long Beach helped me. The Long Beach Tennis Patrons had just started when I started playing. They helped the top two girls and the top two boys. Susan Williams was number one. I was number two.
Your parents obviously saw you rise to incredible world success. When you look back on it now, what is your perspective of what it was they gave up for you and your brother and how much they put into you? How do you see that?
My brother, Randall, and I were very clear that they were giving up a lot at the time. So we had that discussion. I think it helped that Randall wanted to be number one in the world too, basically by being in Major League Baseball is huge in the United States, sure. Okay? And he announced at 10 he wanted to be a Major League Baseball player. And, of course, my family just fainted. Not you, too, they said. I'll never forget their faces at the dinner table. Them going, what? They just looked at each other like, oh, now what? I'll never forget the look. They put their heads down and their hands over their face. Oh, my God. It was like, whoa. So they just knew they were in for it because we were pushing them. And like you said earlier, Kirstie, you know how parents can't wait to do something for their children. Mm-hmm. Let the child figure it out. Let them have their journey. I think that's probably one of the best things they did for us is they didn't care how good we were. Like, I'd come home losing. I'd be so furious. And my dad go, calm down, calm down. He'd go, okay, did you try your best? I said, of course I tried my best. Are you kidding? I said, I can't believe it. He says, well, are you practicing too much? Are you burned out? No, I'm not practicing too much. All right, then do you need to practice more? Yes. Well, I mean, I was crazed. You know, my poor parents.
By the time you got Frank Brennan on board as your coach, how did that change things for you?
Well, first of all, they're on the East Coast in New Jersey. We're on the West Coast, 3,000 miles away. So I'm back East because everything's on the East Coast, the tournaments in the old days. He came up to me at the South Orange Lawn Tennis Club, and we used to have our tournaments there in the old days when we were amateurs. And he said, oh, you're going to be number one in the world someday. And I went, whoa, no one's ever said that to me. He says, yeah, and I've got a huge family. I said, what does that mean? He says, we've got 10 children, or 9 children at that time. What? He says, yeah, if you need a place to stay in the East, because we always needed homes. So I started staying with them. And so I've gone from a family of 2 children to a family of 9 children, soon 10 children. That was a great experience for me as well. But Mr. Brennan was a character. He was fun. The family was fun. It was family life more than thinking about coaching so much, although he would coach me.
I mean, obviously there would be a lot of young, skilled, ambitious players at the time. What do you think it was that Frank Brennan saw in you at that stage to say, you're going to be number one?
I have no idea. I don't know. He just felt it, saw it. I don't know. Anyway, it was nice that someone believed in me that much at that young age, because usually I was not considered. Karen Hans was ahead of me. Kathy Chabot was probably right next to me. I was always hovering. But you know what I did differently from a lot of young people? I try to get young people to think like this, and to get the parents to think like this is even harder, is that it's really important to keep developing your game. What happens in junior tennis, the kids just want to win. I didn't think about winning. I just think children and young people should realize we all have a different journey. You get there at a different time and keep developing your game.
More music, Billie Jean King. It's your 4th. Tell me about this.
Oh, well. Met Catherine Jenkins, nice Welsh, beautiful singer, opera singer, at the Royal Box 2 or 3 years ago. She and her husband, Andrew. So we hit it off. And when we go out to dinner and have the best time, and we're so much older, you know, we're like laughing. So we've got this great friendship going. They're a very romantic couple, which I always like because I think love's so important. And I asked her, I said, could you tell me your 2 favorite songs? And I chose World and Union. She loves singing that one. So my songs, now that I'm even thinking here, that it's kind of bringing people together.
There's a dream.
That was Catherine Jenkins singing World in Union with the lyrics by Charlie Scarbeck, accompanied by the Crouch End Festival Chorus. The music, Thaxted, based on Holst's Jupiter from the Planets. So, Billie Jean King, you arrived at Wimbledon in 1961 with your doubles partner, Karen Hans.
Hans, yeah, Karen Hans. Everybody looked up to Karen. I saw her play when I was 12. I went, oh my God. She was always our number one player.
She was 18, you were 17.
And she asked me to play doubles and I fainted. I said, really?
You said that when you were 12 and you'd fallen in love by that stage already with tennis, that you looked at it and you thought, you know, the shoes are white, the balls are white, the costumes are white, and all the people are white. When you came to Wimbledon in 1961, there was surely nowhere more, if you will, tennis and proper than Wimbledon.
Yes,
then.
It was the
Describe
epitome.
It to me.
But it was elegant, which I liked. I loved tradition. I found that people who create new history, really, or create new things in life have a amazing appreciation of history. And I actually loved it. I loved the whole pageantry. And when was the coronation of Queen Elizabeth? 1953?
Yep.
We just gotten televisions in those days. One family had a television set on our block. And I remember seeing the coronation of Queen Elizabeth as, what, 10-year-old or 9-year-old. And I'll never forget it. And it was really like snowy, blurry, yeah. Black and white. Oh my gosh, I just loved it. And I'll just never forget it. And I think just seeing that as a child and then coming to England, I used to dream about Wimbledon. I used to know all the champions, singles, doubles, and mixed in the old days. I used to dream about it. I used to sleep with my racket, books, sweater, I mean, everything. And so when I finally arrived at Wimbledon, you had to win Wimbledon or you weren't number one in the world in the old days. But I did notice it was all white. I was thinking, I have an unbelievable platform of tennis. How, over the years, can we be more inclusive? Because you don't want to get rid of what you do have. You just want to add to it. But just having such an appreciation of its history and the champions that came before me, I was just in awe. I still am. I just, you know, every Sunday I used to go out before the matches start and sit up in the center court and just take it all in. Just be thankful that I had a chance to play there. All the great names that have walked on to that center court, that's what floods my mind. When I come out and come around the corner at Wimbledon, I used to think, wow, who's played out here? This is such a privilege to be out here.
So much of your story is not just bound up with all of the titles you won. It is, of course,
I don't care about that. So
yeah,
much.
We kind of do, though.
I know. It's nice. It's good for your resume, but it's really the journey and it's the process you go through that makes it worth it. I call it one ball at a time because everyone's into results. No. Stay in the process. Stay in the moment. Mindfulness is big right now.
You're very interesting about the ephemeral nature of winning, is that, yeah, that it is just the moment and then it's gone.
It's totally gone.
So you've never kind of luxuriated in
I didn't have time because I was trying to change the game and trying to change opportunities. Looking back, if I were going to do it over again, if things were different, if I were playing today, I would take a lot more time enjoying my victories. But we always had meetings going on. It was rough. It was a rough time to go through. I always wonder how good I could have been as a player if I hadn't worried about helping women get started. Because if you go back to the 60s, I fought for pro tennis. Thank God the All England Club had a tournament in 1967 with 8 men pros. Rod Laver was that. They weren't allowed to play at Wimbledon for like years and years. And Herman David, who was the chairman, realized we had to stop doing it the way he was doing it. Let's let everybody in. So 1968 was the first year that happened. And that's 50 years ago. This year, I'm like a guest of Wimbledon this year because of Rod Laver and I won it in 68.
Yeah.
So we finally had pro tennis, but then the men rejected us because I wanted the men and women to have one association, one union, and the men said no to us. So we had to start our own thing.
It's very interesting to me that you credit your former husband, Larry, with being the person who really began to introduce you to feminism.
Oh, in a big way. We're walking hand in hand at Cal State LA University in Los Angeles, and we're walking by the tennis courts, which I think is amusing. And he said, "Do you know why you can't get a grant to this school or a scholarship?" He said, "You're the best known person at this whole school of 20,000 students or whatever, how many we had. You know, you're the best athlete here." And he's in biochemistry. He says, "I get a tennis grant, and I'm the 7th guy on a 6-man team." He was hilarious. And he said, "And you can't get any of that because you're a second-class citizen." And why? Because you're a girl, and that is wrong. And boy, when he said that, I knew it anyway, but he just, it was just like a crystal ball sitting right there. He was absolutely right on. But here's a male having that enlightenment. It was quite unusual, and I think it still is to today.
Time for some more music, Billie Jean King. Let's go to your fifth. Why is it on the list, and what is it?
Well, the fifth one is Sarah Bareilles, and it's called If I Dare. And this comes from the movie they just did about my one little sliver of my life in 1973. I played Bobby Riggs, who was a Hall of Famer, won a Triple Crown at Wimbledon in 1939, called The Battle of the Sexes. They wanted a song, so I met with Sarah. She said, "I'm going to see your movie." And I said, "Well, I'd love you to do it." So she watched the movie a couple days later. She called and said, "Oh, my God, I love this movie. It would be a privilege." So she and Nick Britell, they wrote it together. She's beautiful.
If I dare to ask it, I dare it to be true. If I dare to risk it, I know that I'm willing to. If I dare to want this, to want more than I have, then I dare to believe I'll have it in the end." You climbed the mountain.
From the original motion picture soundtrack of the film Battle of the Sexes, that was If I Dare, composed by Sarah Bareilles and Nicholas Britell, and sung by Sarah Bareilles. So Battle of the Sexes then, which of course you won, it took place in 1973. Bobby Riggs, who then was 55, he had been number one back in the 30s and 40s. He challenged you to this match as a self-confessed male chauvinist pig, saying that he could beat you. He didn't. You won very decisively. At the moment that you won, how did you feel?
I felt so relieved and thought we could go forward. But what happened when he jumped the net, he said, "I underestimated you." And I think that's what a lot of people feel about women and others and people of color. Don't underestimate anybody. Ever, ever. My dad taught us that. Always respect your opponent and never, ever underestimate anybody in your life. Ever.
You seemed incredibly even-tempered at the time about the way you were treated. For example, you know, during that match, the Battle of the Sexes match, you know, the commentator would say, "Well, there's Billie Jean. She's charging around the court like a man."
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So where in private, was that making you mad as hell?
Yes, probably. A little more angry. But I also have to understand people and how where we're at. And we still have made very little progress, really. But you know what? When you read history, you'll think it's gone very fast. But when you live it, it's so slow. And I feel like we've hardly made any progress. I'm upset because I'm running out of time. But I also know it's up to the younger generations now. And I've been telling them that for years and years.
Was there a moment that I'm thinking now particularly of the time around about 1973 when it did appear as though huge gains were being made?
We did have huge gains.
Yes.
But it just seems like it's like, let's just make everything equal for everybody. Let's just get the show on the... I mean, I just go crazy because... When you really think about it, but you know, dominant groups know very little about non-dominant groups. Non-dominant groups know a lot about dominant groups. And if you're in a dominant group, you don't understand what we're even talking about because you're so privileged in your life, the way you've been socialized, the old boy network. It's just different. You have the power. You're born into the power just by your gender as a male. And my brother notices it. He can't believe the difference what I've had to go through and he's had to go through. But that's growing up with a brother has been very helpful, I think, both of us seeing both sides of everything. But it's when you're a non-dominant group, you're the one who has to struggle. You're the one who has to fight because you're invisible, basically.
So
we're kind of invisible. The dominant group's very visible. They have the power. So until they make the changes, they have the power to make the changes overnight. Are we being equal in money and in race or not? And you've got to put your feet to the fire. I have a Billie Jean King leadership initiative now, and that's really, we're trying to get equality in the workplace and any place else we can. And we're young still, we're only 4 or 5 years, but we're getting there.
What do you say when a CEO says to you, "You know, Billie Jean, it's quality. Don't talk
I know,
to me." What's your reply? What do you say to them?
I don't say anything. I say, okay, I understand. Because you're not going to get any place with them. You might later. That it's not going to work. You've got to pick your spots. Just like in tennis ring, you got to pick the time you're going to hit a slice or a drop shot or a hard. You know, you've got to pick your fights too because you can't win them all. I have to size up a person. If it's also, do I have the energy that day? I usually do.
Let's have some more music, Billie Jean King. We're going to listen to your sixth. Tell me about this one.
Oh, my God. I remember listening to this, I think, in Cardiff, actually, in Wales, when there was a tournament after Wimbledon. But I also met Dusty Springfield through the years, back in the late 60s and early 70s. And I loved her music anyway. I got to know her and her brother, Tom. Dusty just has a unique voice, I think, that is so recognizable. I think she's one of the all-time greats.
Just
That was Dusty Springfield and You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. So, Billie Jean King, by 1971 then, you'd become the first female athlete ever to win $100,000 in prize money in a single season, and the first tennis player and the first woman to be voted Sports Illustrated Sports Person, crucially, of the year.
I did have to share, though, with John Wooden, who was a great basketball coach, who I adored.
Oh, so, you did?
Yeah, they just couldn't quite give it up for a woman to be on the... Now, the next person who got it was Chris Everett. She got the whole cover, which I knew whoever was the next woman would.
But for you, at that moment, the outer was going pretty well. The inner was a lot more conflicted because you were still married at this time,
yes.
But your private life was highly complicated.
I had asked Larry for a divorce in 1969.
Right.
He said no. He said no forever. I almost still couldn't get a divorce even in the 80s, and we've remained good friends now, but I still loved him too, though. That's also... Shoot, man, it's confusing.
Well, that is confusing, of course, because we like to put everybody in nice, neat rows,
that
and we like
work.
To know who is what.
Yeah.
And there you were struggling with the nature of your sexuality, having come out of a home, as you in your own words said, my parents were homophobic.
Yeah, it was just so confusing. And also in those days, back in the 60s and 70s, no one talked about it. Even gay people didn't talk about it. You know, and Larry and I, we were owning tournaments by 71. We didn't have any money. But we got four other people, we went in and we started the Women's Virginia Slims Tour. And that was a very scary time. It was very high risk. Oh, no, it was crazy. It was a really tumultuous time in every single way. The great thing about when you play a match, it's your sanctuary. When I walk on a court, nobody can get an autograph, nobody can bug me. But off the court, I mean, it was a really rough time. People have no idea we're having, I don't know how good I could have been as a player because I was always having meetings. I'm the leader, it's my job. They always elected me the leader. Even in elementary school, the bicycle committee, I was elected the leader.
I mean, you said that a couple of times now. Do you think it is certainly the case in your on-court life that you didn't quite fulfill your potential because you were so busy with the other stuff?
I'll never know. I think I'm still so lucky compared to most players. 39 Grand Slams? Wow. But I don't know.
Tell me about being publicly outed in 1981.
By Marilyn Barnett.
Yes.
Who's also in the movie.
So this was Marilyn Barnett, who had begun as your assistant, and then you had ended up in a relationship, a relationship which was entirely private because of the times that you were having it in. In 1981, she sued you for palimony and essentially outed you to the world.
Yes, and I lost all my endorsements overnight. And today that would not happen. That's what's good. When I was 37, I was just ready to retire and have these lifetime deals. So this is when I was finally going to be able to make some money, some real money. I didn't even make $2 million in my whole career. Okay, so I played until I was 40 years old, and I made $1,960,000. I should have kept playing until I got to $2 million. But our generation was brave because we actually made it happen.
But as you were coming to the end of your career, as you describe it, and you had this enormous blow of the financial deals being withdrawn, and you also had all the personal stuff to deal with, of stuff that you wanted to keep private being made public.
Yeah, it was terrible.
How did you
deal
with
that? I didn't cope
well.
It was very difficult. And, you know, I've had 25 years of psychotherapy. They saved my life.
They literally saved your life?
Yeah, literally. 1990s, I was getting very, very despondent. I knew I needed help. And I finally went to an eating disorder place, and you have therapy, individual therapy 3 times a week. You have couples therapy 1 a week. You have a lot of therapy. You really do a lot of reflection, and that's where I really came to grips with my sexuality. I was only comfortable by the time I was 51.
Wow.
I think Martina Navratilova, who's also gay, she was much more comfortable, but she's also 13 years younger.
And she also said to me when I spoke to her for Design and Distance, when she was outed, she didn't lose any of her sponsorship. And that was not that long later.
I know, but it was just a few months later, actually. But the point is, Martina came to me at Wimbledon and said, I'm going to get outed by this newspaper guy. And I said, okay. And I'd just been through it with Marilyn being outed in May. This is like now Wimbledon, June, July. And she said, what do you think? And I said, if you're comfortable enough, you need to control your message, and I would come out yourself if you're ready. Nobody can tell somebody else when they're ready. Your body tells you, everything tells you when you're ready, and I don't know, it's kind of a magical moment. I said to Martina, if you can do that, I would control the message and come out and not let this guy out you, because that means they control the message. And that's what happened with me, that everybody's controlling the message except me. I had to argue with my lawyer and my publicist for 48 hours straight. And I said, I want a press conference. No, you cannot do that. That's no one's ever done that. I argued for 48 hours. They finally gave in. All the media were there. I walked in. Larry was there. My parents came up. They didn't know what was happening. It was terrible. Well, they did, but they didn't. I mean, this was all shocking to them. I felt so bad for them and Larry. So I said, I did have an affair with Marilyn Barnett, and you could have heard a pin drop.
I bet.
This comes back to my parents again, that I don't self be true with my mom. Mm. And my dad always tell the truth. You know, it's about family values, really, when you get down to it and you finally have the courage. It was probably, in some ways, a good thing that I got out of it, because when will I ever come out? I don't know. So, you know what? You've got to make the best of a bad, tough, emotional situation. And what I don't like is how it affected some of the people I love. That's the hard part.
Let's take a break for some music, Billie Jean. What are we going to hear now?
Well, what's on my list? Is it Elton?
It is Elton.
Oh, my God, of all the people. How perfect is that? I have known Elton John. I met him 2 weeks before the King Riggs match in 1973. We were too shy to say hello to each other. So Tony King, who worked for Elton, came up to me and said, this is ridiculous. He's been dying to say hello all night. He's too shy. And I went, I'll never forget this. I looked up at Tony and went, ditto. He said, this is ridiculous. He grabs me. He says, come with me. He sits me across from Elton. He goes, Elton, this is Billy. Billy, this is Elton. Start talking. And of course, Elton loves tennis. He goes, oh, I see you on the telly. So we're off and running. And he says, when are you coming to England? I said, not until June. He left a message at the hotel. I almost didn't call him because I'm too shy. I went, okay, hi, Elton. So he comes over in his Rolls Royce and his 28 speakers, and we sat out in the car and just listened to music and talked until like 4:30. We just hit it off. It's like, boom, separate at birth, as Lily Tomlin said. You know, we both wear glasses. We're little chubettes, you know, the whole nine yards. I would have loved to have been a rock and roll star. He would have loved to have won Wimbledon or been in the World Cup. So he got to know me, and then we're in the car. We have two different stories here. He said, I asked him. I would never ask him to do anything. He said, I want to write a song for you. And he had been watching Philadelphia Freedom, which is a tennis team I played on. He had a uniform that Ted Tenling had made for him because he made all of our outfits. And he would cheer and go crazy. You know, he's like, come on. And he said, I'm going to write a song. He calls Bernie Taupin and he goes, Bernie, I'm writing a song for Billy and I'm going to call it Philadelphia Freedom because Elton came up with this title. And Philadelphia, people still play it all the time. It is their anthem. It went to number one. It crossed over into R&B and became number one, which made Elton so thrilled. And Lon and I are on the Elton John AIDS Foundation board since inception of 93. So we've stayed friends forever.
That was Elton John and Philadelphia Freedom. So, Billie Jean King, you have been with your partner, Ilana Kloss, for, is it pushing 40 years now? Is
that close, right? 39 okay. This year, I think.
It might reasonably be said that in the Western world, the progression of rights and equality for gay and lesbian people is maybe the single biggest societal shift. It is very different for young people now.
Yeah, it's huge.
Contemplating
their
sexuality.
They have no idea, which I'm so happy they don't.
How would you, you know, as somebody who has been instrumental every step of the way in helping it along the path of equality, how would you sum up the gains that have been made?
Well, I think it's been the courage of the LGBTQ plus community. I think it's been a one by one by one plus lawsuits, just getting it out there and changing legislation. And it's all about inclusion. Everybody, just let everybody live the way they want. Who cares? As long as they're good people, don't break the law. So there's still countries we'd be killed in. I think there's seven still. And there's about 72 that we'd be in jail for sure. So we have a long way to go. But as far as Britain, as far as America, as far as North America, a lot of the world, it's so much better with marriage equality. But it's, I think it's because the courage of the people.
In 2009, the then President Obama awarded you the Medal of Freedom. That's your country's highest honour. And you were moved by what it was he said to you on that occasion. Just explain to me why it mattered to you what he said and what he did say.
Well, it's the first time any president's ever mentioned the community or LGBTQ community ever, or sexuality ever. And also Harvey Milk posthumously received the Medal of Freedom that day.
And that he was the gay rights campaigner.
He was a gay rights. He was assassinated in San Francisco. So that meant a lot to me. And also I was the first woman athlete, which I find extraordinary. See, that's what gets me. It's good news, bad news. They have awarded so many male athletes, I cannot tell you, because presidents through the years would like baseball, or they'd like football, or they'd like basketball. So they always made sure that they got the guys that they admired or their heroes. It's amazing how far women still have to go, and obviously women of color more, people with disabilities. But I was thrilled that day, and when I met the president a few months earlier, he was 12 years old when he watched the King Riggs match. He said that has really changed his life and how he raised his two daughters. And that's what's happened from that match when I played Bobby Riggs. Women come up to me and say, I finally got more self-confidence to ask for a raise, for instance. And then I say, more importantly, did you get the raise? They said, yes, we finally got it. We waited 10 years and we should have never waited. And then men come up to me and they're more reflective, and a lot of times they have tears in their eyes. And it always gets down to, I have a daughter now. I saw that match when I was 25. Oh, God, I remember that. That's 90 million people. And it was so emotionally charged. So this is what came from it. And every single day of my life, someone's brought up the King Riggs match since 1973. But these are the kinds of things that can happen because sports have a platform.
Serena Williams, who also has a daughter now, is very careful.
So sweeters.
Is very concerted in her efforts to credit what you did before her on the court, and that you built a platform and two different organizations that women tennis players can stand together in solidarity on now. When you look at the women's game, when you look at, you know, we got equality in prize money at Wimbledon in 2007, the last place of the major Grand Slam tournaments to
get it. Venus was very instrumental, by the way, doing that. She met with the All England Club and had them close their eyes and pretend they were 9-year-old girls and took them through it.
Wow.
And say, how would you feel to be worth less? I don't know the whole story because I wasn't there, but that's good influence. Everyone is an influencer. But Serena and Venus definitely believe in women's rights. And now that Serena has a daughter, she's going to think even more strongly about it. But both of them have been transcended tennis. They've been amazing. And they're also on the Billie Jean King Leadership Initiative Advisory Board, which we're very fortunate to have them.
We're going to hear your last disc of the day, Billie Jean King. Tell me about this final one.
This is... We've seen Paul McCartney lately, and Nancy, his wife, is fantastic. But Elton introduced me to the Beatles 1,000 years ago, during the 70s, I think. And we just did the March for Our Lives in New York City, and Paul was there, and we all did it together. So that's been on my mind. And just seeing him through the years, off and on, he seems so happy. And Nancy, his wife, said this guy gets up every morning happy. He doesn't take one medication. You know, he's one of those real positive souls. And then I was just thinking about all the beautiful music from the Beatles through the years and how much I've enjoyed them. And, of course, I wish John was still here and George. But Hey Jude, it was a song to help Julian when the parents got divorced, John and his first wife. And I know how much Elton loved John Lennon, too. So I don't, there's a lot of connections. So that's why I know Hey Jude is supposed to comfort Julian. And any time you feel the pain, you
That was the Beatles and Hey Jude. I'm going to do what I do for every castaway now, Billie Jean King, which is I give you a copy of the Bible and I give you a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah, but I heard what Elton said.
What did he say?
I don't want him.
Well, that's up to you.
No, I'm not going to say that. Are you kidding? I have a choice, right?
Yeah. You want them?
I think that would be a privilege, yeah.
Great. Well, you'll have both of those, and on top of that...
I don't know how I'm going to get them home, but...
We'll leave them on the island for you. But on top of that, you get to take one book with you to add to those, to have a library of three. What will your book be?
I could not come up with a book. It was driving me insane, because I like so many. I was worried at how many days I had to be out there. I need a long, long book. And then I thought, no. And I just love this book, Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You Will Go.
Right.
It's a beautiful little book, and it's a children's book. Doesn't matter what age you are. I think it's inspirational and it's lovely.
Okay, we'll give you that then. You're also allowed, you were cast away on this island, you don't look happy, a luxury item.
No, because I want to bring a scrapbook of my family and everybody, and I can't do that because I need sunscreen. Like, I have the worst skin in the world. So I'm thinking, could I put a blanket or a towel? What if I don't have a towel?
There'll be trees.
I don't know. I'd really love that scrapbook of my family just to look at old photos and new photos. And both parents have passed away now, so I'd love to look at them. And my brother and I when we were babies, you know, it's so much fun. And then Larry and Lana and the godchildren. Just, people are everything. It's like when we started this interview, it was about relationships or everything.
Yeah.
So that's what I really want.
Don't take the sunscreen. Take the book.
I'd rather have the book.
Okay, we're going to give you the book. And finally, if you had to run to save just one track from the waves, which one would
it be?
One of
these?
Yeah.
One?
Yeah.
I'd have to do Elton. I'm tightest with him. My deepest relationship is with him, for sure, of all these.
Philadelphia Freedom is
yours. Well, just because of Elton. It's not the songs, it's the person.
Don't say that. He might be listening.
It isn't the song, Elton. It's you, baby.
Billie Jean King, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Well, it's a privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation there with Billie Jean. You'll find lots of guests associated with Wimbledon in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue. You can hear Kitty Godfrey, who won Wimbledon ladies singles twice in the 1920s. She was interviewed by Michael Parkinson in 1987. Last year, I spoke to John McEnroe. And in 2014, Judy Murray, Andy and Jamie's mum, was my guest. In 2012, I was delighted to meet Martina Navratilova. I asked her about her life in Czechoslovakia before she defected to the United States. You were 13 then when you left Czechoslovakia for the first time for a tournament in the West. What do you remember about that first hit of the West?
That was in Germany and big cars. It was close to an American army base. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of old Chevrolets and Oldsmobiles and Cadillacs. And I've never seen a car like it. I just thought it was amazing. And then the food. The variety and things that you've never seen before. You know, I never saw fresh pineapple.
And did it make you think, I want a bit of this. This feels good.
I didn't feel that I was not getting what I needed in Czechoslovakia. I was never hungry. I was never cold. But I wanted to kind of experience it all. To this day, if I go to a shop and I see a fruit I've never seen before, I buy it. I have to check it out. I have to try it.
And in that same year then, you would have seen, I think you did in fact, literally see with your own eyes, Soviet tanks rolling in to Czechoslovakia. Tell me what you saw and what you remember.
That was the year before. That was 68. I think we went to Germany in 69.
Okay.
So the tanks came first and, it was extremely depressing. It's like you're in jail and you're almost on the other side of the wall and then boom, another huge wall shows up and you know you're never going to get out of the prison. And that's what it felt like. I was at a tennis tournament with my then best friend, but they had a phone and the phone rang in the morning and it was Virka's father calling saying, don't go outside, there's tanks in the streets. So of course we went outside and checked it out and, you know, we're throwing rocks at the tanks, but it wasn't very helpful.
You were playing on professional tour in America in 1975 when you sought political asylum. Tell me about that. How did that work?
My family, we were actually out at Wimbledon in 75, the whole family, my parents and my sister who is 6 years younger. And we were talking about leaving Czechoslovakia, but my father was not sure of himself. What is he going to do? How is he going to provide? He doesn't speak English, you know. So we didn't do it. And then we went back to the Czech Republic about a week later, and there was a tennis tournament there. So we stopped because we knew some people there, and we stopped at the tournament, and they said, oh my God, you're back. Because rumor had it, we defected. But because of that, they didn't want to let me out of the country again. The US Open is coming around the corner, and they said, oh, but you're not going to the Open because we don't want you to travel anymore. It's like, what? So the Czech Tennis Federation got behind me, and they ended up giving me the visa just before the tournament. And that's when I knew I wasn't going to come back, because I never knew whether they were going to let me out again.
Given the conditions at home, were you free to, did you feel free enough to have that conversation with your parents? Did you say?
Oh, yeah. I spoke to my father.
Did you?
And he said, don't tell your mother. And he said, if you're not going to come back, don't come back if we ask you to. If you stay, stay.
Okay.
Even because they may ask us to tell you to come back, but don't.
Why did he want you to not tell your mother?
Because he knew it would just break her heart.
And so, I've never spoken to anybody who's sought political asylum. What actually happens? What do you do?
It was funny because, ironic. I was in playing the US Open, and it was, I talked to my manager, and we decided after I'm out of the tournament, we will do this. So he knew what to do.
What sort of questions did they ask you?
Well, you know, everything. A bunch of people asked me a bunch of questions, if I was a communist, if my father was a communist, and I assured them that I was not, and my father actually got thrown out of the Communist Party because he was not towing the line. And, you know, my parents did like labor camp, not hard labor, but they did both more political kind of prisoners in a way, etc. And so I convinced them that that really was not a communist. I want to be number one. That's all I remember saying. I just want to be number one.
You said that the conversation you had with your father was that he said, you know, if we ask you to come back, don't come back. We'll be saying that because pressure will be put on us. Did you have that conversation with
them? We did speak, of course, but they never asked me to come back. So I was never put in that position. It was just my mom was so sad, you know, because we never knew when we would see each other again. It turned out it was 4 years before I saw my mother, and it was 5 years before I saw my father and my sister.
And how do you think that affected you at the time?
I think it affected them more than me, because I was kind of in control of what I was doing. I was doing what I wanted to do, but you're at that age where you're ready for the world. You know, I was 18, 19 years old. You go to college, and if you don't see your parents for a year, it's not a big deal, except it was, in that I couldn't go back. It was difficult.
Martina Navratilova, and you can download her program and those of Judy Murray and John McEnroe and a whole host of other editions with sports stars wherever you get your podcasts. Next time, my guest will be Baroness Helen Newlove, who's Victims Commissioner and Deputy Speaker of the House of Lords. Do join us.
This is the BBC.
Hi, this is Lauren Laverne. I've taken control of your podcast airwaves for a moment to let you know about Late Night Women's Hour, my podcast for Radio 4. Every week, I talk to brilliant, interesting, funny women about life, politics, friendship, love, instinct, feminism, hair, snacks, money, and, well, everything, really. You know when you talk to your good mates and the world seems to make sense again afterwards? That's what we try to do every single week on Late Night Women's Hour, and we'd love you to join in. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.